This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Yevgeny Prigozhin is in St. Petersburg and has been meeting with some of African representatives on the periphery of the summit. And this morning, there is an interesting recording, allegedly by Yevgeny Prigozhin. It's not confirmed yet that it's actually him, but it sounds very much like him. And in this recording, he expressed support for the apparent coup in Niger.
That was Misha Gotkin, managing editor of the New York Bureau for the Voice of America's Russian service, on the Wagner Group's chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin's support for the recent Niger coup. Details coming up. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump faces major new charges, and the U.N. Refugee Agency urges countries not to forcibly return asylum seekers from Burkina Faso. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Niger's coup leaders said today they have dissolved the constitution and created a military group, the National Council for Safeguarding the Homeland, to run the country. They named General Abdurrahman Tayani as the council's president and new head of state. Tayani was the head of the presidential guard that shuttered President Mahamudu Bazoum in his palace on Wednesday, declaring it ousted him because of bad governance and worsening security. The army has backed the coup despite growing international condemnation, including calls from the United Nations, United States, and former colonial power France for Bazoum to be restored to power as the legally elected president. France's President Macron today condemned the coup, calling it completely illegitimate and profoundly dangerous for Nigerians, for Niger, for Nigerians, for Niger, and for the whole region. But Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of Russia's mercenary Wagner group, hailed the coup as good news and offered his fighters services to bring order. He described it as a moment of long overdue liberation from Western colonizers. Both the United States and France have small military operations in Niger used in combating extremist forces in the region. The UN Refugee Agency is urging countries not to forcibly return asylum seekers from Burkina Faso. The UNHCR reports increasing numbers of people are fleeing escalating insecurity and violence from armed groups. It says it is concerned about the recent coup in Niger and is monitoring developments there, but for now it says its operations for refugees from Burkina Faso and other countries are continuing.
The UNHCR says it is updating an advisory it issued a year ago because humanitarian and security conditions in Burkina Faso have seriously deteriorated since then. The UN Refugee Agency says violence has expanded to previously peaceful areas, leaving fewer safe places to which people can return. UNHCR Director of International Protection Elizabeth Tan says human rights violations against civilians, including targeted killings, are widespread. She says forced disappearances, torture, and kidnappings are on the rise.
Children are also exposed to serious human rights violations such as forced recruitment by armed groups, child labor, as well as other types of violence, abuse, exploitation, and gender-based violence. Ongoing violence and displacement have also left many women vulnerable to gender-based violence, and survivors have difficulties in accessing services.
Since the advisory was issued last year, Tan says Ghana has forcibly returned several asylum seekers to Burkina Faso. She says the UNHCR has discussed the issue with Ghana's government. While forcible returns have somewhat subsided, she says the UNHCR remains concerned about that situation.
And we understand, as you're mentioning yourself, the intense security concerns that countries in the region have with regard to population movements. Nevertheless, the majority of the people fleeing are women and children, and we are working with governments to ensure that the civilian character of asylum is maintained.
She says the current situation in Niger, which is a major country of asylum, is a concern. She says the UNHCR is monitoring developments, considering the recent military coup there.
So it is very much a country that is affected by insecurity in the region. And so we're monitoring very closely. For the time being, our humanitarian operations are still able to take place.
The UNHCR reports political instability and frequent attacks by armed groups have prompted some 300,000 people from Burkina Faso, Mali, and Nigeria to seek asylum in Niger. In addition, it says violence inside Niger itself has internally displaced 350,000 people who also depend upon international aid for survival. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, conducted a groundbreaking new study titled Soldiers and Citizens, Military Coups and the Need for Democratic Renewal in Africa to make sense of rising constitutional manipulation and the alarming uptick in military coups in Africa. The first key finding was a preference for democracy by African citizens. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the findings with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The recent coups have certainly demonstrated a deep disconnect between citizen preferences and those who would derail democracy. And you know, there's a lesson here that unless there are strong enough guardrails for democracy, there are always going to be some individual who would want to seize power if they see that opportunity. And so an important takeaway has to be that there needs to be stronger democratic guardrails. And the first step towards that is to not recognize coups and coup leaders when they do seize power. What we have seen is that in this recent spate of coups, they've all been really self-serving power grabs. The coup leaders have not affected any sort of governance reforms or security reforms that are improving the lives of citizens in these countries. So it's all about a power grab. And to push back against this, it's going to require pressure from both domestic sources and international sources. Now, domestically, that's going to mean civil society, the media, other political leaders. There needs to be more democratic civic education about the responsibilities of citizens to uphold democratic norms and just what those norms are. Internationally, it's going to require regional bodies and international organizations to not treat these coup makers as the de facto heads of state. And I think on a hopeful note, when we look at history of democratic transitions around the world, especially in the global south, it's not uncommon to see democratic backsliding. In fact, in 40% of the cases, you see some cases of democratic backsliding. But even in those cases, two-thirds of the times, there's a rebounding towards more democracy within a couple of years. And this shows the resiliency of democracy and democratic aspirations among citizens. And once they have a taste for democracy, once they've had an opportunity to participate in political life and have a say over their leaders and policies, citizens don't want to give that up. And so there will be continued pressure for change.
The second key finding was that a development lens is essential to mitigate coup risk. This calls for comprehensive and integrated solutions, instruments like the newly launched Africa Facility to support inclusive transitions represent a unique programmatic intervention that could contribute significantly to resolving gaps in current international and regional responses. Can you explain how such an arrangement works?
This is an initiative that was launched just on July 15th. By the African Union and UNDP on the sidelines of the 5th African Union mid-year coordination meeting in Nairobi. And the aim is to do two things. One is restorative work with countries where there have been coups to get them back on track for a democratic transition. One of the realities of the coups that we've seen is that the military juntas have agreed to certain timelines, 18 months or 2 years, and then completely ignored those timelines. And they've taken no steps really to facilitate a transition. And I think this has been one of the shortfalls of the negotiations between some of the regional economic communities and these junta leaders by leaving it up to the juntas to organize their own transitions. You know, they have no incentive to do so. So this mechanism becomes a more formalized instrument that the AU can use to help create a structure for actually getting the transitions into place and gaining some momentum. They can help incentivize it with some development initiatives and other mechanisms, and to see if these transitions can actually be implemented. The second element is preventative. The idea is to be more proactive in young democratizers that may be vulnerable to coups, and trying to be more proactive in investing in development, reducing some of the grievances that can be used as a pretext for military actors to seize power.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Vladimir Putin's hope for a big show of support at his Russia-Africa summit does not seem to have materialized. Just 17 African heads of state, according to Russia's tally, showed up in St. Petersburg. That's less than half of the 43 leaders who participated in the first Russia-Africa summit in 2019. The list of notable absentees included the leaders of several large nations, including Nigeria's Bola Tinubu and Kenya's William Ruto, as well as Felix Tshisekedi of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda's Paul Kagame. Many African countries share Putin's contempt for U.S. and European economic sanctions and have called on the West to lower its financial weaponry aimed at Moscow. But Russia's decision last week to pull out of an agreement with Ukraine to enable the export of grain and to then bomb Ukraine's ports, destroying thousands of tons of food, enraged countries such as Kenya, which lambasted the decision as a stab in the back. I asked Misha Gutkin, managing the editor of the New York Bureau of the Voice of America's Russian service, if the perception that the African continent as a whole is leaning towards Russia is a mistaken notion.
So I think it's a bit of a mistake to talk about Africa as a whole, because it's a continent that has, 54 countries, and they have different interests and different levels of development and different approaches to international relations. So yes, some countries whose leaders are not in Moscow are apparently upset at Russia's withdrawal from the Black Sea Grain Initiative. Other countries are more willing to listen to Russia's concerns, as, for example, the chairman of the African Union said, speaking in Moscow, that the West and African countries should listen to Russia's concern that led it to leave the Black Sea Grain Initiative. So I think it's a little too early to say whether Vladimir Putin was mistaken in thinking that Africa is going to lean towards Russia. And if he is mistaken, it's not for the lack of trying on his part. He is courting Africa. Today he announced a new round of debt relief for some countries. Yesterday he pledged to supply grain and other agricultural products to a number of countries. He also mentioned today that the volume of trade between Russia and Africa is right now $18 billion. And this is kind of interesting because it's actually less than it was in 2019 when the first Russia-Africa summit was held. And at that summit, Putin pledged that this volume of trade would double. Now, granted, in the intervening years, there was a pandemic that slowed down the international trade and all kinds of transactions. But still, that pledge that was made by Putin in 2019 did not pan out. And we'll have to wait and see whether Russia can fulfill all its pledges to African countries and continue its war in Ukraine without damaging its own economy.
And lastly, Misha, Russia has said it will continue to deploy Wagner forces in Africa, despite the Wagner Group's boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin, mounting a failed mutiny last month. Any news on that front?
Yes, there is some interesting news. As we know, Yevgeny Prigozhin is in St. Petersburg and has been meeting with some of African representatives on the periphery of the summit. And this morning, there is an interesting recording, allegedly by Yevgeny Prigozhin. It's not confirmed yet that it's actually him, but it sounds very much like him. And in this recording, he expressed support for the apparent coup in Niger, saying that this is also part of the anti-colonial struggle of the people in Niger and on the African continent. And taking that with the appearance of some demonstrators yesterday in Niger with Russian flags, this may be an indication that Wagner Group is very much interested in moving into this country where political situation is destabilized now, even as Prigozhin's own situation inside Russia remains uncertain.
That was Misha Gutkin, managing editor of the New York Bureau for the Voice of America's Russian service. Former U.S. President Donald Trump faces major new charges in the classified documents case against him. The Office of the Special Counsel, led by Jack Smith, has accused the former president of trying to delete security camera footage at his Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. Trump is still the Republican frontrunner in the 2024 U.S. presidential election. VOA's Carol Van Dam asked award-winning Minnesota criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor Jack Rice about the third person in the case named as a defendant late last night and what his alleged role is in the documents case.
It's really interesting because this person is essentially one of the managers at Mar-a-Lago. So this is one of his employees. And so when you add these additional charges, the charges are actually against this employee. So that makes two employees now. But it's also against Donald Trump himself. And so what you're seeing is these additional charges are basically saying that on behalf of Donald Trump, this other man did something in committing a crime. So they charged the both of them.
This is a superseding indictment on the one allegedly mishandling classified documents announced already earlier. Why is this happening now?
Well, we're starting to see an expansion now. We're starting to see more and more. And it does appear that the Bureau, the FBI, was involved in thinking about this issue earlier on because they were pursuing this investigation and they knew they had more questions. And so we're starting to see this expansion. This is the nature of how you do an investigation and how you indict, certainly how the Bureau indicts, because what they're doing is they're starting to see this broader than just one individual, multiple efforts to try to obstruct, trying to destroy evidence, trying to hide evidence. And so you're pulling more people in. The benefit of something like this, the benefit of charging employees, is that you can put enormous pressure on an employee to essentially flip and to testify and cooperate in the indictment, in the prosecution of the figure at the center of the investigation, meaning that you go after the employees of Donald Trump in order to help bring Donald Trump down. That's what the Bureau is doing.
Is there a chance that the other defendants will be given immunity if they work with Jack Smith on doing what you just described?
It's likely that they will be given sweetheart deals at minimum. They could actually be given immunity because these are employees who are doing something at the behest of the former president of the United States that comes with an enormous amount of pressure. And I think that Jack Smith will understand and recognize that because it's not them that Jack wants. It's the former president.
What is going to be Mr. Trump's defense strategy for fighting these charges and the old charges?
He's going to certainly try to create walls and say the decisions that they made were their decisions alone, not mine. You don't get to charge me with the crimes of others. So he's going to try to avoid responsibility based upon that. But he's certainly going to talk about his lack of knowledge in terms of what that means. The problem with that type of a defense is that cuts straight against the potential evidence that you have from those witnesses themselves who may come forward, and I don't have this specifically, but who may come forward and say, I did this because the former president told me to.
That's Jack Rice, a criminal defense lawyer, former prosecutor, and former U.S. Central Intelligence Agency officer. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is an El Niño year. Normal weather patterns in the eastern Pacific Ocean are disrupted by a warming of surface waters. El Niño occurs usually every 2 to 10 years and impacts weather conditions around the globe. Typically, within El Niño, you will see global reductions in economic growth and country-level impacts that can actually persist for years, said the U.S. State Department's Special Envoy for Global Food Insecurity, Carrie Fowler. You also typically see global declines in production of some of the major staple crops, wheat, rice, maize.
We're already seeing declines in fish harvest off the coast of Peru. And in fact, just recently, Peru announced that it was suspending the anchovy harvest there for the first season. The last time they did that was the previous El Niño, 2014-15.
That's important, noted Special Envoy Fowler, because anchovies are a main ingredient in many animal feeds and fish meal. He said that fewer anchovy harvests in the early 1970s led to higher grain prices and a global food crisis. And he stressed that from a food security standpoint, the United States is keeping a particularly close, watchful eye on Southern Africa, on Central America, and Southeast Asia. El Niño is also correlated with an uptick in conflict, warned Special Envoy Fowler.
It's a threat multiplier, doubling the chances of conflict in Africa and playing a significant role in over 20% of the conflicts there since 1950.
We can't change the weather overnight, but the State Department has been the catalyst for a number of programs which are directly related to how the world is going to be responding to this El Niño and future El Niños, said Special Envoy Fowler. Programs such as Adapted Crops and Soils, which explores how traditional and indigenous crops in Africa will do in a climate-changed world, and USAID's program in Africa that's bringing drought-tolerant maize, for example, to millions of farms across Southern Africa. Working through the Department of State, Special Envoy Fowler noted, the United States government is partnering with the African Union and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization to bring more attention and more investment to the traditional and indigenous crops starting in Africa. The fundamentals for food security, stressed Special Envoy Fowler, are healthy, fertile soils and crops adapted to both the weather and to market conditions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.